pray. God, as we continue talking about change this morning, you know how much of us we have inside us that tells us that it's about us, that it's going to be about our impressive efforts. And you know there's even that temptation in a service for us to think that it's about us and our impressive efforts. I just ask that you would make this morning a time of learning, that we might be able to come to a clearer understanding of what it is that holds us back from being the people that you created us to be, and what role you play in this thing called change. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. I want to do a little survey this morning. Does anybody know what is the key trait that distinguishes those that are really good at what they do from all the rest? In whatever area of work that it would be, across the board, the key trait that distinguishes top performers from all the rest. Anybody know? Passion. What's that? Flexibility. What was that? Perseverance. All good, all good. You know what? I think this is the first service that somebody got close to the answer, which is flexibility. Which is actually what they have found is that the key trait across all the different areas that distinguishes top performers from the rest is the ability to deal with change. Ability to deal with change. And actually, to encourage this kind of participation, because I want you guys to continue to treat this. So these aren't hypothetical questions that I'm asking. They're true questions. I actually have a prize for you, okay, since you got this right. So this is from you. This is from you from Crossroads. You can open it now or, you know, later if you like. It's AOL 9.0. You laugh, but it's optimized. I mean, it right there. So 1,045 hours free for you for being on the ball. They have found that. They've done research, and they found that across all different areas, the number one trait that distinguishes top performers from all the rest is the ability to respond to and deal with change. And so in the series, The DNA of Change, we're trying to tear apart change to its very core components and understand what is this thing called change, how does it affect us, and most important of all, what does God have to say about growth and change in the Bible and how that applies to us. So as part of breaking down its core, one of the things that we found is that across the board, all of us share some of the very same barriers to change, some of the very same things that stop us from growth, that stop us from changing. And that's what we're going to spend some time looking at today. The first barrier I think we all share kind of has to do with how we tend to think about change. When we hear the word change, our default mode is kind of reacting, well, change, yeah, that's these big moments that come at you in life that you need to respond to and deal with. You know, maybe it would be coming to a point where you realize, I need to switch careers. Or maybe that it's some crisis that comes your way that you need to respond to, or some habit that you have that you gradually realize is actually an addiction and you need to do something about. And we tend to think that's what change is about. And certainly, those things hit us, and those things require us to change. But I think there's a danger in that because we tend to think about change as being these big moments. And what happens is you tend to look at even those moments that I just talked about. Most of the big moments that hit us are actually made up of a slow, gradual progression of smaller moments that we ignore. A lot of us tend to lose at the big moments in life because we lose the big in the small. It's in the small moments and it's in the small challenges to change and growth that we look past or we find ways to medicate around that eventually become these big moments that sometimes we don't pass because we lose the big in the small. Big stuff is almost always composed of small little changes that needed to be made along the way. And it's a theme that comes up again and again in the Bible. For instance, in the Old Testament of the Bible, there's this book, Song of Songs. And actually talking about a different topic here, but in the midst of this, they make this statement, which I think is fascinating. Catch for us the foxes, the little foxes that ruin the vineyards. And the Bible talks about this in terms of that it's these little things. In this case, it's the little foxes that ruin the vineyard. Not these, big wolves that come prowling down from the hills. It's the little foxes that we don't see that on a daily basis nip and nip away at the vineyards, and that's how the vineyards get ruined. We did that series this last summer, Everyday Enron, where we took a look at a lot of the integrity crisis that we see going on in our country. Particularly in business. And one of the things we looked at there was this common theme, for instance, in Enron and other organizations, that it wasn't this big moment that came along that somebody didn't pass the integrity test. Instead, what happened is there was this slow, gradual erosion of integrity and making wise decisions along the way that built up and ended up snowballing. It was the little foxes that ruined Enron. And you know what? Little foxes don't just ruin businesses. Little foxes don't just ruin vineyards. Little foxes are the ruin of governments, of friendships, of relationships, of families. If we're going to be people who are about growth, who say we actually want to be somebody who responds to change, we need to collectively commit here that we're going to be people that catch the little foxes before they grow big. That we're going to be relentless when it comes to the little things that bubble up in our life, that we're going to deal with those challenges on a daily basis and not take the easy way out. We're going to catch the little foxes before they grow big. I don't think there's probably any place that this kind of pops up more than in marriage. Nancy and I have been married for a little over 12 years, and we have found that there's these little things that kind of creep up into the relationship that if we don't deal with, eventually become big problems. We had this a few years ago. We were sitting down and talking, and I realized that we had this kind of little thing that had crept into our family. And I don't know exactly even quite how to word it, other than we didn't kind of approach things in a team, in kind of a team attitude. And I think I own the vast majority of it, whether it's because of our personality differences or whatever. When we would come at a decision or something we disagreed on, maybe it was how we were going to spend the money or how we were going to discipline the kids, whatever that it was, it would seem much more like we were kind of going at each other. And it was me versus her, as opposed to the two of us together as a team against this challenge or against this problem. And I said, man, this is deadly. I don't like this kind of atmosphere that I've cultivated here. We have to come at things more like it's us against the world. One of the things that we did as part of that, not that we have it completely conquered, but one of the things we did was some friends told us about this marriage retreat way out in the northern tip of California in the middle of this national forest. And what they would do is you'd go out there for a week in the summer, and it would be a mix of talking about your marriage, spending time with these other couples, talking about your marriage, learning a little bit more about, you know, God's design for marriage, and then also interspersed in that, because you're in the middle of this national forest, were all these very active challenges that you had to overcome together. You know, and there were high ropes courses, whitewater rafting, hiking, all this kind of stuff. And I thought, this would be great. We will go out there and we will beat these other couples. You know, we will what a perfect environment. We'll go out there, we'll beat them, we'll maybe even shame and humiliate them. And in doing so, we will become a more loving couple, as God intended. Perfect plan. Perfect plan. So we went out there. It wasn't quite as I thought it would be, but it was really good. And we ended up one day was all about just the high ropes course. Now, has anyone here ever done a high ropes course? Anyone? Yeah, what the high ropes course is, it's kind of way up in the trees, and it's these cables and ropes that are strung from one tree to another with these challenges you need to get across to get there. Maybe it's trapeze bar, maybe it's grabbing rope to rope, maybe it's climbing up these climbing pegs, whatever that it would be. When we get there, one day's devoted completely to the high ropes course in the middle of this forest. We get there, there's a clearing in the middle of the forest, and one of the things by the ropes course is this pole, and it's about a wooden pole about the dimensions of a telephone pole. And it rises 40 feet into the air. And they called it the 747. And the reason why they called it the 747, the 40 came from the fact that it rose 40 feet in the air. The first 7 came to its name because on the pole, there were all these different climbing knobs that got farther and farther apart as you reached the top. And if someone, I don't know why they would choose to do this, but if someone chose to climb the pole, what would happen is when they got to the top, if you made it, you'd have to find some way to kind of like hoist yourself on top of the pole, of which they had nailed a 7-inch wide piece of wood for you to stand on. That was the 7 in the 747. The last 7 was because if you chose to climb the pole and you somehow made it top and you climbed on top of the 7-inch wide piece of wood, suspended in the air 7 feet in front of you was a trapeze bar you had to leap for, and that was the only way down. Well, there was one other way down. You know, you came down one way or the other. And unfortunately, they talked about as perceived risk, because you had like a safety harness on, and there was a rope, of which that if you missed the bar or you fell off the pole you're trying to climb, the belayer down below would see you and would tighten up on that rope real quick before you hit the ground, you know, which is a good thing. The bad thing was the belayer was like this 17-year-old kid who I could tell didn't have enough sleep the night before, so we look at this thing, and I can tell Nancy's a little intimidated by it and say, hun, you know, it's okay. I've done this kind of stuff before. It's always challenged by choice. They never force you or coerce you into these kind of things. So, you know, don't worry. If you don't want to do it, you don't have to. Well, we spent the day on high ropes course, and I chose to concentrate our time over on these high ropes challenges over here because they looked like they were kind of a good workout. And also, if I busied myself with that, no one would notice that we weren't over at the plunge of death, you know, the whole day. So it actually worked out. The end of the day comes. We'd avoided the 747. almost everybody had. There'd only been a few people that had tried it and plummeted and fortunately been caught before they hit the ground, you know, so. Finally our leader yells, "Hey, it's time to go. It's time to, you know, wrap up the ropes and everything. You know, we got to head back down, for dinner." So I'm over there, I'm like taking my helmet off, and then this thing happens, and we still haven't totally gotten to the bottom of where this came from or why this happened or whatever, but we're putting the helmets down, and suddenly Nancy says, "I want to try the 747. We were almost gone. We're a team, right? We're a team. We're working together. And that, you know, it's, oh, I want to try the 747. So our leader, who's this kind of real daredevil kind of guy, this bungee jumping, skydiving, rips the do not remove tags off his mattresses kind of thing. He looks at me, and in front of the whole group of the other couples, he looks at me and says, "Well, Brian, Nancy, your wife is going to do the 747. She's going to face her fears. She's going to take the challenge. She's going to bring her A game. She's going to live life as it's supposed to live. How are you ever going to look her in the face again, you little man from Ohio?" All right? Now, that's not exactly what he said. What he said was, "Brian, do you want to try it?" But wait, I could tell. You could tell where he was going with that in front of everybody else. So, you know, there comes a man, time in a man's life, he has to draw the line, you know, you got to step up. So I said, "This is the moment, this is my moment, I'm going to step up." "No, I'm not doing it. I'm not doing, you know, I gave up on this peer pressure thing sometime like around sophomore year of high school. No, I'm not doing it. I'm not going to be pressured. I'm not going to do it. I'm a man. I don't want to do it because I just don't want to." "There, now back off, buddy." Well, that's not exactly what I said. What I said was, "Okay." So kind of strapped me up, you know, and we, so we found ourselves scaling the 747, you know, and, I ended the story there in earlier service, and people came up and said, "Well, did you make it or not?" Now, here's the thing. Do you think I'd be telling this story if I didn't make it? You know? I caught the bar that day, my friends. But what we said was, we'll try this stuff. We'll do whatever that it takes to deal with these little things that are building up in our marriage. And sure enough, later in that week, toward the end of that week, we were at a talk they were giving one night. I don't remember what the guy was talking about, but I just felt this kind of conviction in my conscience coming over me that I felt was God really convicting me. And so I'm saying, "Brian, you need to ask your wife for forgiveness. In these 12 years of your marriage, your words have been reckless with her. You haven't been careful in your choice of words when you're delivering criticism. You have not served your family the way that I would have you serve them. You need to ask for forgiveness." I thought, okay, I'll write that down. We'll get to that, you know, at some point. And I felt God say, "No, now. You catch these little foxes now." So I actually, you know, grabbed Nancy's arm. I said, "Hey, can we talk outside?" So guy was still talking. You know, we kind of walked out of the back. And, well, truth be known, we actually got in an argument first, okay? But then the special moment came, okay? We got in the morning, and then, and I said, "You know what? I just need to ask for your forgiveness. I have been reckless in my choice of words with you. I've been lazy in my choice of words. I have not served you as I believe God has called me to serve this family. And I have talked about things from the stage at Crossroads that I haven't applied in my life with you. And I need your forgiveness." And it was just kind of like this dam broke. And then she started sharing this stuff with me where she said, "You know what? There's little things that I've let creep up that I haven't served you in the way that I think I'm really called to." And, you know, none of that came about because we were at this major crisis. Anybody was packing their bags or asking their friends for lawyers' names or anything like that. None of it came about because it's big crisis. It came about because we started to identify there's these little foxes. We are just not going to let these run through our vineyard. And we all have them. We all have these little foxes. I don't know what it is for you. Maybe for you it's around work. Maybe you just dream of this promotion that you're going to get that's finally going to put you at that place that just puts you in your sweet spot of what you do well. Maybe the first answer is you need to get to bed a little bit earlier tonight so you can bring all you have to work this week. Maybe there's some little foxes you need to deal with. Maybe you're in college and you're working hard and you're studying and you're hoping that all these classes and all the work that you do is going to put you in the right place for the career that, you know, you just exactly want. Maybe part of the answer is you need to make sure you don't take any ethical shortcuts on that paper that's due Friday. Maybe it's about the little foxes. Maybe you've decided 2004 is going to be a year you get your finances in order. this is going to be the year. This is going to be the year where you start to honor God's wisdom and what he says about your money and giving it away and sharing it with others. Maybe it's going to be a place where you get out of credit card debt. You've decided 2004 is going to be the year. Maybe it starts with being brutally honest on that tax return you've just started. Maybe it's about the little foxes. Maybe you're married. You're a married guy, and you've never talked with anybody about this before. But you know what? Just between you and me, you've been married for a while. The sex isn't really where you'd like it to be. Maybe it starts way before you get home. Maybe it starts with you watching where you let your eyes wander and stopping them from wandering and stopping those second looks so that what you bring home starts from a more healthy place in the first place. Maybe it's about the little foxes. Again and again, we ignore these little foxes or we find ways to medicate around them, and then they jump up as being big calls for crisis and change in our life. And the answer is we need to commit that we're going to catch the little foxes before they grow big. That's one big barrier that I think we all share. There's another one, and the way I can best talk about it is with the term, a term that I've heard before that I did a little research on this week, called prime directive. Prime directive. Has anybody here ever heard that term before? Anyone? Where have you heard that term, prime directive? Star Trek, yes. We all know now a little bit more about you than we did before. Yes. Star Trek. I have, I'm not watching much Star Trek, but I've heard this term before, prime directive. Prime directive in Star Trek missions, the crews had all these directives of what their orders were and the principles they needed to act by on these missions. But each one was superseded by the one before it, so you couldn't compromise directive number 4 just to do directive number 5. The number one directive, the prime directive, the one they could never compromise, wasn't their only directive, but it was the one that trumped all the others, was called their prime directive. And that was that wherever they went, they were to never interfere with the development of foreign civilizations. So they weren't to go to a new planet, and they weren't to implement new technology that was foreign to them. They weren't to alter the course of the history of that planet. They were never to interfere with the development of foreign civilizations. Even one of their other directives was to preserve life, but they were not to preserve life at the cost of directive number one. It's the prime directive. It trumped all the others. Now, I learned this week, spent a little time online, and you learn a lot about Star Trek fans, more than you ever wanted to know. I'm still trying to purge my computer. One of the things you learn is Star Trek fans take very, very serious the prime directive. They're passionate about that. I stumbled onto one website where there's this big chat room full of people arguing about how the prime directive from Star Trek applied to their personal lives and their stand on various social issues and how they would vote in the upcoming elections based on it. How the prime directive applied to birth control, you know, or not. Wow. Now, I know we have Star Trek fans here, so I hope you're in a safe place, okay? Hope you're in a safe place. I have something I need to say. Not even quite sure how to say it. It's just a show! It's just not real. It's not the phasers, the whole thing. It's not real. It's just a show. You shouldn't be living your life based on what, you know. You know, we say, you know, sometimes we just need to be about hard truth here, okay? So I know you're hurting right now, but, you know, hopefully. I want to be careful here, though, because I've found Star Trek fans are not a group you tend to want to tick off. You know, I tend to found most of them have significant access to technology, and when there's not a convention in town, they tend to have a lot of time on their hands. So you need to be, just want to be, you know, send a nasty email to the pastor, touch up the paint on my new spaceship model. Send a nasty email to the pastor, touch up the paint on my... Not sure what I've done. I'm feeling a vibe kind of similar to the touch by an angel backlash I got hit with a couple years ago. I'm not sure. That would be Brian Tome at crossroadscommunity.net. You know what? I did find, though, Star Trek fans take the prime directive very seriously. They all know what it is. You know, as I think about it, what I realize is we all take the prime. They're not the only ones. We all take the prime directive very serious as well. We all have a prime directive, whether we consciously admit it or not, we all have a prime directive that's governing our life. And for a lot of us, it is our key barrier to growth. Because for a lot of us, our prime directive is we make comfort our prime directive. Make comfort our prime directive. Not that it's our only goal, not that it's our only objective, but it is the one that trumps all the others. Yeah, I'd like to do this, I'd like to do that, but not if it's at the expense of comfort. Not if it means I need to go to a place of pain. No, life is about pain avoidance, isn't it? Life is about comfort. And you know what? It's such a commonly held thing. I mean, I say, yeah, our lives are about, you know, we all want comfort. Our lives are about comfort. So much so that the only controversial thing about me saying this right now is that I seem to be indicating that it shouldn't be that way. And it shouldn't. Again, it's a theme that is run laced throughout the Bible. Here's the way James talks about it. The book of James in the New Testament of the Bible. James 1, 2 to 4. Consider it pure joy, my brothers, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith develops perseverance. Perseverance must finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. Key thread in the Bible is that sometimes we are called to break through comfort. Sometimes we are called to go to uncomfortable places, even places of pain, because that is where maturity comes from. Maturity comes from the point where you're willing to sacrifice comfort for growth. Last week, Brian talked a little bit about what, you know, scientists have learned about DNA. And one of the things is they've learned is that all healthy things grow. All healthy things grow. And you know what? I think that applies to our spiritual DNA as well. All healthy things grow. We need to make growth our prime directive. We need to make growth our prime directive. You know, and this is not saying that we need to run to pain, we need to pursue ways to suffer, anything like that. It is a thing that we need to recognize that there is such a thing as good pain. There is such a thing as something that we can learn from. And we need to learn to distinguish between good pain and bad pain. I was thinking about this summer, and I thought they worded it great, Drs. Henry Cloud and John Townsend, in a book called How People Grow, that I read this summer. And they talk in there a little bit about the difference between good pain and bad pain. Here's what they say. If one of you walked out of here, and a guy with a mask walked up to you in the dark parking lot, took out a knife, stabbed you in the stomach, took all your money, and left you in an unconscious state, you'd call him a mugger. Someone would call the police, and they would try to find the perpetrator. But if you left this meeting, drove down the street to the local hospital, and a guy with a mask came at you in a brightly lit room, he took out a knife, cut your stomach open, took all your money, and left you in an unconscious state, you'd call him a doctor, and you'd thank him for helping you. One is a mugging, the other is surgery. Suffering is a lot like that. There is therapeutic suffering, and there is destructive suffering. They go on to talk about it a little in there in a theme that we've seen at Crossroads is that one of the key differences between good pain and bad pain is a very simple question we ask ourselves. One of the key differences between good pain and bad pain is asking ourselves, have I been here before? Have I been here before? Bad pain is the kind of pain that comes at us because we haven't dealt with the little foxes. Bad pain is the kind of pain that comes at us that's the same place we've been before, but we took a short-term solution out of it. We took some medication that kind of masked the symptoms but didn't get rid of the disease. Bad pain is somewhere we've been before that now we're back in again because we didn't take the hard call and learn and grow from it the first time. Good pain is maybe something that comes at us in the same way, but we ask hard questions of ourselves. We don't grab for the easy kind of medication that's going to get us around this thing. And we ask ourselves, what can I learn? And we look for the lesson. And because we do that, we don't return to that same pain again. And it feels a little weird for me to talk about this because I have no lack of bad pain in my life. Places I've gone again and again because I haven't dealt with stuff straight up. And I think about one, a few years out of college, we talk about, you know, is your life at all about, you know, God or what God means to your life, trying to understand. Not only was my life not about trying to understand who God was or what it meant for my life was not about anyone but me. Everything was kind of my pleasure equation. Everything in my life, and I define thing as anybody but me. Everything, my job, my friends, my girlfriends, whatever that it would be, it was all about how can I maximize my pleasure? What is this person about for me? And the result of that was some nice, you know, kind of career progress. But on the relational front, the result was I went through this string of very unhealthy relationships. Sometimes I would be the one to end it. Sometimes they would be the one to end it. But it always seemed to end it because it was somehow around the idea of you're not meeting my needs like I really want you to anymore. Because I was just all about what can I get out of this person. I continued on that kind of trend. And I got in a relationship, but this one started to be a little bit different. Started to get fairly serious. And we weren't engaged, but we were starting to talk about it and what that would mean. But I was still coming at it and treating it in the same unhealthy way and using her in the same ways and all that. And I was working late one night and stopped by her apartment on the way home from work. And I walked in the front door, and a guy was walking out of her bedroom with no clothes on. And you just, I mean, if you've ever been in that kind of place, it's just this bad cocktail of emotions. I mean, it's everything. It's anger, it's pain, it's disappointment, it's rejection, it's self-esteem. It's all this kind of stuff wrapped up in there. And a lot of stuff came crashing down around me. That relationship ended, and I started on the same trend again. But somehow, a friend challenged me this time. And I started to ask some harder questions of myself. Things like, why is my self-esteem so wrapped up in these other people? Why am I on this continual trend in my life, you know, that looks like this? And I even started to ask questions about God, started to ask some deeper questions about, is there a God? You know, what would he look like? What would he want from me? You know, those kind of things. You know what those things did? They took me to more pain. It took me to even more uncomfortable places. I couldn't reach for the same medication I had before that would just mask the symptom and enable me to move on. I couldn't just move into the next relationship real fast and turn up the volume on that one. I had to go to even more pain and more discomfort. But you know what came out of that? What came out of that string of bad pain was finally, this time, it became good pain. I said, have I been here before? I said, yep, sure feels familiar. And I learned these hard lessons about myself, and I started to discover who God was. And out of that, I grew and I changed. You know what? I have never had to go back to that kind of place again. It became good pain. And I look at my life now, and I look at most of just the most incredible gifts I have in my life right now. I never would have found the wife that I had if I hadn't gone through that good pain. I never would have had the kids I have. And you know what? During that pain, when I started to redeem it as good pain, I made a couple friendships. And out of those friendships, we started this church called Crossroads. Because for once, we took that pain and it became good pain. You know, the Bible has even a little bit more vivid way to talk about this principle. In Proverbs, it says, as a dog returns to its vomit, so a fool repeats his folly. Key question to differentiate between good pain and bad pain is, have I been here before? And what am I going to do about it? Am I going to reach for the same relief that will mask the symptoms and leave me with the sickness? You're on your third job in 2 years. Maybe you need to start asking, maybe is there something about me? Do I not respond to criticism well? Do I have a problem with authority? Have I been here before? Maybe you're on a string of relationships that go to a certain place and then you just don't want to be vulnerable. And you start to push the person away. Have I been here before? Maybe you've got a string of people in your past, friends, that you could all write off in certain ways because of where their faults are. But if you were honest, you'd find the common denominator is that thing went south because at some point you didn't control your mouth and you hurt them with your words. Have I been here before? The fact is, we cannot live without growth. Growth needs to be our prime directive. You know, at the end of the last series, we decided to do something different. You know, we've every once in a while we'll open up the mics here. We'll do an open mic thing, and it'll be time you can come up and ask questions about God. You can come up and ask questions about Crossroads. You can come up and criticize what we're doing, you know, whatever, you know, that you might want to do. And we do that, and people just flood the mics, you know. So we said, hey, you know what we're going to do this time at the end of this last series, the Not-So-Big Christmas? We're going to open up the mics, and we're just going to let people come up and share how they're feeling challenged and how they're wrestling with change based on the series. And we did that. And, you know, the silence was deafening. And I know some people are just, you know, kind of hesitant about coming up to a mic or something in public, but that never seems to stop people when they have a bone they want to pick with the church. Never seems to stop people when they have some penetrating question they want to ask us. But then we open it up and say, how are you changing? How are you feeling? How are you struggling with this? I have this concern that we treat coming here as, oh, I now know it, so now I've changed. No, changing is in the doing. And it's in the sharing our story with each other. We cannot live without growth. We cannot grow without risk, and we cannot risk without pain. It's just part of the equation. So we got these barriers. You know, we lose the big in the small. We don't deal with the small foxes. We prioritize comfort over everything else. And over time, if we don't get past these barriers, we start to feel this certain frustration. And over time, we don't get past these barriers, something kicks in and we just start to feel a little numb. And we start to surround ourselves with people who will tell us it's okay not to change. It's okay how you are. And we grow kind of numb and we get to this place where we just kind of settle. Yeah, here's where at one point I wanted to be and here's where I am right now and there's this gap between here, so that's where I just settle. And the reason why I do that is I think a third barrier that runs throughout these other barriers that we have to wrestle with, the most important one of all, we start to think about change and we think that it's about doing it ourselves. We think that it's about my impressive efforts. It's the American way, right? I try and I try. I work harder and harder. And if I'm unable to change, what's left? If I can't do it on my effort, what's left? This gap, that's where I settle. When instead, at some point, hopefully sooner rather than later, we start to realize that that gap between the desire of where we'd like to be and where we are is actually a clue that we were meant for something more. It's actually a clue that we were meant for something more in this life than we can do. And it's a clue that maybe we need outside help to close that gap. That gap is this hole in our lives, and we shove all this other stuff and think it's going to fill it. When finally it doesn't, we just settle in it instead of realizing that that hole has a very peculiar shape. And it's God-shaped. You know, if I ask you what do you think is the organization that's most responsible for the most people's lives really changing, let's say in the last 50 years in America, you know, I don't know what you would answer. You know, I would like to say it's the church. I don't think so. Unfortunately, I don't think so. You know, the organization that I think is responsible for more lives really changing in the last 50 years in America is Alcoholics Anonymous. In a lot of ways, they have been the church way more than the church has been the church. It's true. I mean, some places you have to go to the basement to get grace. And I'm not saying we do things perfectly here by any means. But I think they're the organization that has most lived it out. And you know why? Because it's all based on biblical principles. I don't know how much you know about AA, but it all comes right out of the Bible. All the principles was a guy who was a follower of Christ who wanted to distill God's wisdom for how he could change. So much so that you know what the historian that wrote the story of AA, the historian who wrote that book, you know what he titled it? Not God. Meaning that our first step is to recognize that we are not God. There is a God and we are not him. And that we can't get to any place of change until we recognize that. There is a God and we're not him. AA's recognized that as a very first step, you can't get anywhere until you acknowledge somewhere deep down inside you that there is a God and you're not him. And our frustration in this change thing comes when our efforts don't bring it about. When actually our efforts are important and there's a part for our personal discipline, but the fact is we won't change until you ask God to change you. The last part of the equation is we need to ask God to change us. And you know, we have folks in here all over the spiritual spectrum. You know, folks, a lot of folks are just asking, is there a God in the first place? All the way to, you know, all over the place. And you know what? That's awesome. That is exactly what Crossroads is for. And we have folks in here all over the spectrum of how long you've been coming. I do have this concern, though, wherever that you are. I have this concern that if you come to Crossroads and you find a little kind of habit for healthy living this week, kind of tweak your life here, kind of massage things there, and kind of apply it all in a real self-help nature, I have a concern that if you come here and treat it from a self-help standpoint, at the end of the day, your overall response, your overall experience to being at Crossroads is going to be frustration. Because the pictures that we paint up here, what we're talking about up here, this life that we're talking about here, you can't do, and neither can I. It's about us putting ourselves in a place where God changes us. Us saying, there is a God, and it is not me, and I want to learn more about what his plan is for my life. And yeah, there's a role for my discipline, there's a role for me doing these things, but without God, nothing's going to come of it. We need to ask God to change us. Because the fact is, all growth, Cloud and Townsend talk about this in their book, all growth is spiritual growth. And God wants so much more for us than what we've settled for on our own efforts. Book of Jeremiah in the Old Testament. God tells us exactly that. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you. Plans to give you hope and a future. God says, I want so much more of you and for you. But it's going to involve me working change in you. Nancy and I, often in the summer, we'll go on vacation up to northern Michigan. And this place that we've stayed before, there's this cottage, little cottage, and behind the cottage, there's this huge sandbox. And when John was 4, he loved that sandbox. Couldn't get enough of that sandbox. It was just, you know, just loved it. So we'd drive up there, and the first day, he'd get in that sandbox, and every morning, when he'd get in the sandbox, and he wouldn't want to leave. Now, you know, like a day or two of that, it's kind of cute, but we were only about 10 minutes from Lake Michigan. Only about a 10-minute drive from Lake Michigan, and tried to take him out of the sandbox, and went, hey, we're going to the lake, awesome, and he threw a fit. You know, he did not want to leave the sandbox, I said, well, hey, you know, this vacation's about our kids too, but it's also about us. We're going to Lake Michigan. You know, John had no idea all the sand that was in the sandbox, how much more there was there at the beach. I mean, that there was more sand at that beach than he could ever eat, even in a day. You know, the more sand there, there were waves there, there were seagulls, there was all this kind of stuff. He had no idea. So to pick him up out of the sandbox, and he cried, and he yelled, and he felt discomfort, and we got him to the beach. And he loved it. He loved it. It was so much more of what he wanted. And to this day, he loves it. But it involved me, his dad, having to pick him up out of this little sandbox and show him that there was another place I wanted to take him. I think our father looks down on us and our little sandboxes that we settle for in the name of comfort, you know, or whatever that it's in the name of. We, in the name of just what I can do and that's it. We settle for these little sandboxes and he looks down at us and he says, but there's so much more. There's so much more I want for you. The plans that I have for you. It's only 10 minutes away. Let me take you there. But it may actually need to go through a little discomfort. You may actually need to go through a little pain. But you won't believe what I have waiting for you. There's so much more than this little sandbox. But it involves change. And yes, it involves pain. I'd like the band to come back out. There's this tension in the equation that is what we bring to it, are making good choices, are being disciplined, and what God brings to it and how God works this change to us. And it can be kind of a funky equation of, okay, well, where's my role and where's God's? That's exactly what we're going to dig into next week and take a look at is how does God actually work change in us and through our choices? And that's this mystery that we're going to dig into a little bit deeper next week. If you'd stand with me, there's a song that song they did at the very beginning of the service. And I want us to do it again, only this time the band's not just going to play it, but we're going to sing it with them. And I think, as I thought about it, I think there's kind of three different kinds of songs that we do here at Crossroads on the weekends. One of them is a song that they perform that, you know, is just kind of about the human condition. It's just kind of about recognizing the reality of the challenges we have and, yeah, the pain that we have sometimes. And there's a second kind of song that we sing, though, that is about God. We sing it about God, and it's about God and his attributes so that we can learn to internalize more who this God is that loves us. But there's this third kind of song, and it's this kind of song that the band has written that I want us to do. This kind of song recognizes the reality of those first two, recognizes the reality of the human condition, recognizes the reality of who God is, combines those, and this is a song based on that that we sing to God. So I want to treat this as kind of a prayer that we sing to God about us saying, God, I know it's about you, and I want you to work your change in me. I don't know where you are today. I don't know what kind of challenges you're facing. A lot of us don't even know ourselves what we're going to face this year. I do know that there is a God who knows every dirty little thing about you and loves you. And he loves you too much not to have you to change. Let's pray. God, help us live in this tension of what we do combined with the necessary work that you do in us. Help us change, God. Help us change to be more like your plan for us. In Jesus' name.